Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Jen Earick. Jen's a marketing strategist who believes in solutions that work in the real world for real people with real results. She creates strategies for action based on human insights. Her approach starts with one question: what's going on? And she believes that answers come from listening empathetically, observing deeply, and engaging enthusiastically. She's the founder of Sparrow Strategy in Portland, Oregon, and obviously Portland at the moment is continuing to be in the news in terms of the activity there, so we can talk about that obviously in a while. Back to the world of agencies, etc. In a previous life, she was the group planning director at Wieden Kennedy, the amazing Wieden Kennedy. And before that, she was the director of account planning at Chris and Porter Bogusky. That's when CPB was without doubt one of the top two agencies in the States. Absolutely fantastic. And prior to that, she was the director of account planning at J. Walter Thompson Worldwide. She also, again, in previous life, was a volunteer for the U.S. Peace Corps, was an associate consultant at Bain & Company, and she did her BA in Economics and Political Science at Yale, followed by a master's at Yale in Public and Private Management and International Business and Social Marketing. She also does a ton of volunteering in terms of activity based around civil rights and social action, also more later. So, Jen, great to talk with you again. And how are you, and how are things in Portland today?
Well, thank you for having me, Sean. Things in Portland are quiet in every part of the city except 4 blocks around the Federal Justice Center, where there is an ongoing conflict since the federal government brought in their own people to take our people off the street in unmarked vans, etc. So it's been it's an optics opportunity for President Trump, and unfortunately, he's chosen our city to make as his stage. We, as citizens here, have rallied. We have a wall of moms who are going down there, or mums, as you say in England, to protect both the protesters and other families that are going down there. Though it's changed in that the local president of the NAACP has talked about the fact that it's time to move away from the violence and move into policy and legislation and actual change. So he called on the city and on the protesters to back off. It's a small group of people, I must say, and tend to be anarchist in that they're not right and they're not left. They have really no political orientation, but they're rather against any form of government control. My partner is a journalist, and he's spent nights down there with his gas mask on, and he has pointed out all along that there is a subgroup of people who are creating the violence. It is not all of Portland. It is not this liberal city that is against our institutions. That is not the situation. A little bit of truth-telling and fact-finding is required to really understand the full story, as it always is.
As it always is, yeah, exactly. As you say, trying to find out what's going on. And in terms of what's going on, I mean, actually, be really brilliant. Perhaps just go back to the start, Jen, in terms of, I mean, it's always interesting, to go through everyone's career, how they got to where they are now, be it either a deliberate road or a very windy sort of path there. So, I mean, you've had a really interesting career, to put it mildly. So, yeah, go on, then just give us a good talk through Yale onwards.
Well, I'm going to start with, I'm Canadian, though I do have an American passport and I have the equivalent of a Mexican green card. So I am the true representation of NAFTA, even though that's not, that no longer exists. I actually think as a result, I'm a little like Pico Iyer and his Global Soul book. I don't really have a country. I think my heart is Canadian. My head might be American, and yet my spirit is definitely Latina. So I think it's the ability to cross boundaries and borders and see as more of a person of three nationalities or three countries. That I think that really has actually helped me in my job, maybe more than anything, certainly more than the Yale MBA. But so that's a little bit of the background as to who I am as a person. I think in terms of my career, I may be the only person who has left Bain & Company and joined the Peace Corps in the history of Bain, which was really, it was absolutely worthwhile. I think most of the people that I was working with in Boston at the time went across the river to Harvard Business School, and I went and built a hut on the beach in the Philippines where I had to start a fire every morning to have my coffee. And it really, I actually think that was probably the best training I've ever had in terms of becoming a planner. I do think that the understanding, the sitting back and listening and watching and observing in a Margaret Mead, truly a Margaret Mead sense,
was
probably the best training I ever had. Also, living what David Brooks, the New York Times op-ed person, calls, useful discomfort. And I would say that it was at 25, that was useful discomfort. It was an adaptation. And I think I took the skills that I learned as a Peace Corps volunteer and certainly brought them home. You also miss the fact that I can take apart and assemble a diesel engine, because after business school,
very
I went
good.
Straight to Cummins Engine Company, and I worked in industrial marketing. And that was also a challenge. I didn't speak Spanish at the time, and I'm certainly not an engineer, but I continued to see the Dodge Ram truck go, which dominates the farmland of Oregon with my diesel engine in it, because I worked with 20 engineers at Chrysler to install that engine. I was the only woman in the room. I was the only non-engineer and I was the only non-Spanish speaker, but we accomplished it. So every time I hear the thump of a diesel engine, I think that's my truck. So once again, I think I learned resilience and adaptability early on. Skills that are required by brands, organizations, and people, especially these days.
Yeah. I mean, on that thing in terms of resilience, and again, jumping onto, you know, just the, you know, you say either the greatest sort of a psychological experiment of all time, or the greatest sort of a government sort of mess up, to put it mildly, of all time, from the point of view of the pandemic. I mean, obviously, from where we are now, summer 2020, actually, literally just this week, over here, say in the UK and Europe, we're seeing sort of potentially a second wave kicking off. But meanwhile, certainly the headlines here, when we're looking, you know, over the Atlantic towards the US, seem to be, again, just increasingly bad about how things are. So, yes, how's it actually been in Portland for you and those around you?
It has been a time of reflection. It's been, I think I read recently that we've all gone through Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief, whether it's anger or depression or at this point, people are cycling through those a little bit more rapidly, but also figuring out a way to work with what we're now accepted, at least here in Oregon, is going to be a long-term existence. And so I think, once again, I have been resilient. We just completed a bunch of online Zoom focus groups with engineers and architects around a new HVAC system, which is very important given that indoor air quality is going to be important. We would have done those. We would have traveled to do those. We would have met people in their offices. We did it all online using a tool called Mural, which is a collaboration tool that's been really helpful. And it's just a matter of adapting in the business side. And in the personal side, I live in a neighborhood where we have had a group sing every Saturday night for the last 18 weeks. We put together a song list, somebody manages the speaker and downloads the lyrics and uploads the songs, and we sing. And it has brought our neighborhood together in an unprecedented way. I think that's just an example of what is happening in the world. I think we've gone back to basics. I see a lot of dads with their kids in the park. I see a lot more families together. I see people making puzzles online. I see this return to the things that we all did when we were kids, which I think has probably been a good thing for the digital generation that's followed us. I think everybody's getting a little tired of screens and finding that the analog world has some pretty terrific advantages.
Yeah. And just tell me that, I mean, the neighborhood singing. So go on then. So what? Just talk me through exactly how you do it. So what? Everyone actually sort of meets together and sings what? In the street or on their balconies and in a sort of in an Italian type way or what?
Exactly. We were inspired by Italy. And one neighbor said, why don't we get together and sing? And she put together the first song list. Now we all stand equally, you know, apart. Some are on their balconies. Some are in the street. We have multi-generations here. We have a 3.5-year-old and we have a 75-year-old. So we were arranged. Our songs are often, they can be a little snarky, which is really fun. Things like I Will Survive or I Want to Hold Your Hand. Sorts of things that that my clever neighbors have come up with by Googling around. We upload the song list to either Spotify or even Amazon Music. And then somebody is responsible each week. We switch off and we send each other song suggestions. But what it's done is that every Saturday at 6 o'clock we meet, and then at 7 we're done pretty much, and we just chat. At that point, we catch up on what is happening. We find out that the librarian has opened the library. We find out who has traveled and how they've done it. So it's just an exchange. And we've always had a community sort of email list, but we haven't spent nearly this much time together. And we sure know each other. Some of us can sing well and some very badly, but it's all good.
Fantastic. And so, getting back to, again, sort of, you know, the route to where you are now. So, yes, so after you've been at Cummings in Mexico City, so working on the development of the diesel engine, fantastic. Go on then. So you then jumped into the sordid world of advertising. Go on then. So talk me through that when you joined J. Walter Thompson.
Yes, Steve Richards came to Mexico, and he's a Brit, and he said, I will not run the Kellogg account without an account planner. I was good friends on a personal level with the female director of J. Walter Thompson Mexico at the time, and she said, I don't understand why you're selling diesel engines. Come work for me. You've got this Bain background, and you've got an MBA. She didn't really understand that the actually traveling around Mexico and visiting 250 diesel engine shops, which is what I did, was probably the best training for being an account planner at Thompson at the time. I was probably one of the few foreigners who could speak not only the language, but also understood the culture. So I worked there for 4 years, and then I met Jeff Hicks. He was on the Leo Burnett side. We were always trying to steal, I think, Cocoa Krispies from them as they were trying to take cornflakes from us. And he actually moved back to the U.S. and went to Crispin Porter. So he called me at some point and called Rich Rivera, who is the media director, and asked if we would join him. At that point, I think Crispin had maybe 50 people. And so I joined as the sole planning director. And that's when I met you through Graham Hall and Informer. You guys really were the back bench of the planning department, since it was just me at the time. And you had stunning work on the initial strategy for Truth, and I just slotted in after you guys did that planning work. So and Crispin at the time, as you mentioned, was really extraordinary place to be. We often had clients that had very little money, and so we became very scrappy in terms of our approaches. After I left Crispin, I went to Wyden, where I was permalancer. I was there for years. And they hired me, I think, to ask about what we were able to do at Crispin. How did we do all that guerrilla marketing before guerrilla marketing was actually a thing? And that was, I believe, why they were interested in having me come out. And it was something that everybody does now. So we were on the cutting edge at that point.
Well, so and just in terms of the back to the Chris and Porter days, and so so the Truth campaign. So I mean, obviously that is, I mean, it's just for any of the people listeners that aren't sort of familiar with it, I'll just do give a quick sort of 2 minute overview, and it'd be great to hear your sort of your stories about it. So because again, so I wrote that up for my first book, The Post Truth Business, and so the Truth campaign basically is one of the most successful marketing campaigns of all time, that saved thousands of lives along the way. Basically, the background to the whole thing is this. So tobacco industry, the only industry that gets away with selling a product that kills its customers when used as intended. The products they sell kill more people than terrorism, AIDS, murder, suicide, fires, alcohol, and all illegal drugs combined. Fact. So one of those. And from the point of view of that campaign, the tobacco industry has an endless requirement for new consumers because it keeps killing so many of its current ones. So it targets young people. Hence, Chris and Porter Bogusky and the Truth campaign. Go on then, Jen, talk us through what it was like for you working on that and what you got up to, because it was just an epic.
The brilliance came with the strategy of pulling the curtain back on the tobacco industry. There, we investigated other ways in, such as health effects, such as, and kids thought that they would, you know, they'd rather get hit by a bus than die of cancer at 50. So at this point, the idea of industry manipulation strategy actually came from a public health study done by Stan Gantz out in California. And that was the original idea, was reading that paper, which I believe Alex Bogusky did, and said, I think it's this. And as you know, because I think you were there, the kids were brought together, the Florida kids. It started in the state of Florida with money from the suing the tobacco companies that our governor at the time, Lawton Childs, promoted. With that money, kids from all over Florida were brought together, and Informer ran them through sessions. Originally, Dave Clemens, the creative, wanted to call the brand Rage. There was a decision to make this a brand. It was going to be a youth brand, as you know, cool as Vans at the time, and as cool as Marlboro Man, actually. So the idea was, we need to make a brand to confront a brand. We don't want to do a typical PSA advertising approach. And so what happened, though, was meeting with the kids, sharing them information such as the statistics that you just shared, they said, we're not mad. We're confused, and we want to know stuff. We want the truth about this because we haven't been told it. So the name evolved from Rage to Truth, which was perfect for this information savvy generation. Maybe our generation of Gen X was mad at things, but these kids just wanted to get smart. So I think that was probably the second brilliant thing after discovering the industry manipulation strategy. And then I think the third was having the kids be the spokespeople. So there was a shadow marketing organization that was made up of teenagers, and they showed up on the Today Show. They were national. They made national news, and the tobacco industry really couldn't take on kids. If it had been a bunch of adults, they would have come after us, but they couldn't take on Jared. He was a 16-year-old from Miami. So I think those elements helped make Truth such a strong force. There was also a movement behind it that students working against tobacco, and that was more of the movement arm. I do think I continue to judge the Effie Awards, and I see the Truth case studies repeatedly. The agency has changed. I think they're now with 72 and Sunny. And one thing that they're doing, and I suppose it's because we've changed in the last, well, it's interesting, 30 years or 20 years. Alex Bogusky said, we will never demonize smokers. We will always accept them. We will never say, don't smoke. We will just share the truth. And some of the more recent campaigns have been all about shaming smokers. So for those of us who originally worked on Truth, we were finding that really difficult to stomach. though at the same time, with the adoration of Hollywood and the stars amongst kids, and everybody wants to be famous, I suppose that might have a different influence. I still think revealing the dirty deeds is pretty effective. In fact, they have taken on vaping, and they've done it in that way, because the vaping companies were just taking a playbook out of the tobacco companies. It was really pretty egregious. And then when Philip Morris bought Juul, it was just that was just the final insult to those of us who actually really care about kids and about public health and about honesty and integrity in business practices. So they've now, Juul has had to step back for sure with legislation, which was great. But it's been interesting to watch both the evolution of Truth plus vaping. And then just to share with you, the Truth work helped me. I've done a lot more social marketing ever since the Truth campaign, mostly because I've learned how to apply the tools that we use for, you know, we're selling Nike to women in Asia or beer to high life drinkers. Applying that to social problems has just been fascinating, and it really works. So we were hired by the governor of Colorado, Hickenlooper, who actually ran for president, when Colorado legalized pot for the first time. They were the first state to do it. He said, hey, this happened on my watch. I'm not necessarily in agreement, but I don't want a future generation of Coloradans to be stoned all the time. He said, what can I tell the kids of our state to get them to stop and think twice about pot? And so that was a question, just single-minded question. And we got our documentary film crew from Oakland, California to accompany us. We had two big SUVs, and we drove around Colorado for a week and a half. We debriefed at a ski house in Breckenridge. And we gave the governor a campaign idea, which was basically, hey, this is a huge social experiment. We don't know enough about pot and its effect on kids and their brains. There was not the studies done. There was not the information that existed for the Truth campaign. So we had to plant a seed of doubt. And we did find some statistics that scared kids, such as a tie of young marijuana use leading to increased schizophrenia, for example. There were a few very shocking statistics, but basically we just said, hey, do you want to be a generation that's experimented on? Because this is unknown. And the campaign that came out of that was don't be a lab rat. And rat cages were placed around Boulder and Denver. It was a small pilot project. And with information inside the cages. So it was pretty
fascinating. Very good.
Some very good work as well. And that was taking what we learned with Truth and then applying it to the next thing that was in front of kids in terms of how they handle and deal with life. We took that knowledge and we came to Oregon because Oregon was the next state with legalizing marijuana on the ballot. And we worked with our local state representative to write the legislation. Everything that we learned about mostly edibles and packaging and approaches in Colorado, we made sure that was written into the legislation in Oregon. So we worked with lawyers, and lawyers do not write in the same way as copywriters. So we ended up testifying in front of the Oregon Joint Committee on Marijuana, which is a strange name for an initiative. And so we went down to our state capitol and became the experts on what we learned in Colorado and how Oregon can learn from that. So that was just a little bit of how some of the work we do can have a ripple effect over other policy and legislation and actually more kids.
Very good. I mean, and also I think that really interesting now that Truth's also sort of linking up with dealing with the whole issue about the opioid epidemic, which is something that we see obviously from this side of the Atlantic as being a massive thing in the States, you know, luckily far less here, although it obviously it is here, but extraordinary. But that point you make about also having to make, again, the great sort of key thought when one was looking at the tobacco industry from the point of view of industry manipulation just putting under that clarion call of, you know, their brand is lies, our brand is truth, but also not making truth sort of worthy and dull. I mentioned in the first book, in the Post-Truth Business, that issue of again, you mentioned the sort of ripple effect and how the same sort of a thought process was often, I think, being used, for instance, back in the 2016 election, as it is now, as we're moving towards the sort of November election in the US, from the point of view of things like fake news and just catching out and dealing with Trump and all the rest of them when they're lying, but not doing it in a dull, worthy way. You know, Clay Shirky wrote a really interesting piece in The Guardian at the time that said, you know, you've got to make it interesting because you can't bring fact checkers to a culture war. You know, one of those. They say fact checkers are terrible at telling stories, unlike agency people, etc. So anyway, after that, then moving on, you then went over to, again, the wonderful Wieden Kennedy. How was that? And what was it like?
What I loved about Wieden was everybody got to share their opinion. And if you weren't doing something interesting on the weekend, you weren't having an interesting life and you couldn't bring something interesting into work. Wieden hired people based on could he sit next to them on an airplane and enjoy it. And so that was part of what I liked about Wieden. They had excellent traffic people. So the creatives were nicely aimed at what they needed to do. Everybody at Wieden was able to work at the top of their skill set is the sense that I had. And we worked on teams. So it was pretty concentrated. The Nike group was a large group and I helped them out. But I was mostly working on Miller Beer and Power Bar and some new .coms at that point in time. But I ended up continuing to work for them mostly on Nike and as a consultant doing collaborative work sessions. So we were working with the Nike women's business and we went to Seoul, Korea and helped sort through what the Asian Pacific strategy should be for women by pulling Nike representatives from all over the region. And it was Thailand, the Philippines, as well as Japan. So you had this range of countries, range of development, and trying to find the common thread that would motivate women to work out and consider athleticism as part of a lifestyle that's not necessarily in the Asian culture. That was so successful. We actually did the Dove campaign before Dove did it, but we did it in a Nike way. And that was what was, that's what ended up being, that's the advertising. But then that was so successful that they asked us to also go down to Mexico to do the same thing with Mexican women. Once again, we did a collaborative work session. We followed that up with ethnographic research. Creative director came to the work session, which he was kind of grumbling about. And then during the session, he wrote on a napkin, Querido Mexico, which means Dear Mexico. And he came back and created the Dear Mexico campaign that you can still Google. And it was basically a love letter to Mexico from Mexican women saying, I'm going to continue to fulfill my role, the one that you expect. I will be a great mom, and I will cook the way I cook, but I am also going to go and swim in the morning, and I'm going to do that every morning. So just get used to it. So it was an empowerment message. It was Joe Shands was the creative director, and it was lovely to see him sitting there through a whole day. And our collaborative work sessions are a lot of fun, but sitting there and actually really starting to understand what drives a Mexican woman and where Nike could have a significant, relevant, resonant role in her life. So that was that's the kind of work that I enjoy doing when the team can get together and actually everybody listens and everybody coalesces around the idea that gives you goosebumps. And that happened a lot during my time at Wieden. I enjoyed that collaborative thinking and the democracy of ideas. Then led very strongly by a powerful creative idea, because those creatives are just super talented.
No, absolutely fantastic. By the way, just going back, you mentioned Miller Beer there. Wasn't that years ago? There was the please tell me if it's true or not. There was the was the great story that I think Wieden's were always trying to get fired from the Miller Beer account because they had to go to to go to the worst possible part of America is basically to go and look after the client. And also, and it's really difficult getting back to Portland from where it was, sort of Milwaukee or something. Is that true?
Yeah, that's a little true. My family was living in Milwaukee at the time. Graham Hall actually even did a project for us, and he spent a night at my family's farm outside of Milwaukee. So it wasn't that bad. But I think what was interesting about Miller was that we worked on the High Life campaign, and it was always the sort of the forgotten stepchild. And whenever they couldn't figure out what was happening with Miller Lite, we would get the media money. They'd throw it at us, and we'd put the High Life ads, which were wonderful, the old High Life man, TV. And Letterman loved it. So the late night shows would pick up on the ads. And honestly, we had a sales spike immediately following any of this sort of hand-me-down media dollars that we got. I still remember taking the sales graph and the media spend chart and putting it up against my window at Wyden and showing the shadow effect of the minute we spent money, the sales went up. And so it was such a powerful, iconic campaign. It's still fun to work on. And the challenge that I was given at the time was, how do we make the crotchety old High Life man feel a little more social? And so that was actually the evolution that happened. And we just wanted to make sure he was only cast when the casting director would just look at the size of a person's hands. That was a casting reel for High Life, because he was supposed to be this working man. So you never saw his face. You just saw his hands doing something or his feet doing something. You never saw his face, but you also never saw him with anybody else. So he became a little bit of a scary creature. So we made him slightly more social. So he had a wife and he interacted with people. And the compelling part of the High Life commercial was that we were selling beer to basically people who were sitting in cubicles and didn't know how to change the tire on their car, let alone the oil. So they were all thinking about their grandfathers when they bought High Life. So it was kind of one of those working class brands like Pabst Blue Ribbon that appealed to these people who weren't living a blue collar life or their grandfather's existence, but we're somewhat nostalgic for it. So it had a little bit of an ironic twist, but it was a another wonderful approach to how to sell beer by Wyden and Kennedy.
Okay. And then in terms of bringing it right up to date, so you then founded Sparrow, and I know we'll go through that in a second in terms of, you know, existing to shift the thinking of brands and organizations in a really, really dynamic and sort of catalytic way. A couple of days ago, you emailed me and talking about the issues with regards to the fintech world and the world of finance and issues around truth. And these issues around sort of truth and trust and transparency have seemingly absolutely exploded over the last couple of years, with endless reports into the problems that brands are having with being trusted in an environment which is full of mistrust. So perhaps just talk me through that, how you're looking at brands now, the sort of prism that you're looking at brands in general when it comes to something as crucial and sort of fundamental as trust and indeed truth.
Well, actually, the World Values Index, which is the link that I sent you, has been fascinating, especially for working with global clients. So we were working with a global digital payment company. I went to Mexico, my colleagues went to Brazil, India, and Japan. And it was fascinating, because looking at institutional trust versus personal trust, and looking at sort of top-down hierarchies, such as the dominance of the church, for example, in these different cultures was really fascinating. What we found, and this was in the final report, is that trust does not come from being good at what you do. Trust comes from being good to people. And trust comes from ethical behavior. It comes from paying attention to people's needs. And ultimately, and this is in the report, from responding to their fears, their loves, and their hopes. And that's what we learned, that when you think about Brazil, Mexico, especially, banks were big institutions that people had learned not to trust. They trusted their family, so they had workarounds, such as lending pools or lending circles where they just lend within their family. Plenty of inequality in terms of access to capital. And so we marrying a more open digital access to help transactions, but also access to capital was a sea change for them. At the same time, these cultures are pretty traditional and smartphones is new technology. So we needed to understand who can we talk to within the Mexican family, for example, who will adopt this technology and then influence others within their realm. And that's exactly what we found is that the young people they didn't want to stand in line at the bank. They didn't want to deal with banks. The older people couldn't get bank accounts. So there was a way that we used the family dynamic to introduce the technology and feelings of trust. The other thing about our client is that they have a guarantee that if a payment doesn't go through, they had a whole group of people that were following up to absolutely clarify where it went, what happened, and rectify the situation. That is not something Mexican banks do. They would just continue to pile on fees and charges. And so not only did they have a technology that worked, but they also had the value orientation or the understanding that they had a skeptical consumer and they needed to go the extra mile to make sure that if a transaction went wrong, they'd fix it. And they did. Okay. And that was key.
Okay. And then in terms of sort of, skeptical consumers and technology and all the rest of it, so again, another of the really sort of, core themes of our time is privacy. LinkedIn in the context of this to things like obviously surveillance capitalism, hence books like The Great, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. And again, obviously we've seen this year in the context of the pandemic, issues around obviously increasing amounts of tracking technology being put onto phones, which people are agreeing to have or not agreeing to have from the point of view of, the public good. How's privacy sitting now with, should we say, with the North American consumer?
I don't think I have a lot to say about that, to tell you the truth. I do know that one of my clients had worked at a cybersecurity company and they were incredibly busy, but mostly helping businesses ensure that the work that was being done at home was kept private. I think that we're behind Europe in terms of our approach and our concern about our data being sold and used and us being looked at. I think, you've passed legislation that prevent that kind of thing. I think that Americans are somewhat, who cares? I think it's a small group of people that are deeply concerned. And I think, especially at this point in time, we've got so many other things that are grabbing our attention that I'm not sure that is one of the ones that is salient at this point. But I'm also not very cognizant of or have worked on anything involved with that.
Okay. Well, what about the issue of the shift, the sort of behavioral shift and also the attitudinal shift that we're reading a lot about at the moment, which is the shift from a self-centered, inner-focused, me to a more of a collaborative, collective community, we. Again, do you buy that, the from me to we move that's going on, that let's say where I am now in the UK, we can see examples of this everywhere. Is it playing out in a similar fashion where you are?
Yes, and talk to me after November 4th because
yeah, exactly.
I absolutely believe that there's a generation that has taken the Declaration of Independence to the extreme, and there is a deep-rooted concern for self and for me and mine in a certain generation. And I think that the next generation coming, and these are Bernie's kids, the fact that these troves of millennials and younger were attracted to a crotchety man from Vermont who could be their grandfather, it says something, because he was basically saying America needs to be more like Canada. And he wasn't being terribly extreme, though he was positioned as revolutionary, but his idea of universal health care, a universal education, those are values that you see, those are ways of life in places like Canada and Sweden and Denmark and the developed world, France. Yeah. This is not something that America has done. America has had, we don't even have compassionate capitalism right now. We just have voracious capitalism. And as a result, all of the unemployed have all lost their health care at this point in time. And the Republicans continue to ask for, abolish Obamacare. Now, how does that make sense? So it's time for a change that starts to share the wealth in this country in a more equitable way. And that's the idea of undoing unequal. And that is exactly what this pandemic, like Black Lives Matter, the economic slump, the people who have actually died from COVID-19, it has pulled back the curtain and revealed the lack of a social safety net that exists in this country and the deep need to have one. 1 in 6 Americans is proud of our country right now. 1 in 6.
1 in 6.
So that is a statistic that says we are not on the right path. And I do think that change is coming.
Yeah. I mean, on that exact last point, and certainly from a UK perspective, it's always been, I think, a real truism that of the many things that confuse us about the US, I mean, obviously many things we absolutely adore about North America and all the rest of it, but there are many things that do confuse us. One of them is just that just inexplicable attitude, certainly from the right in America, from the point of view of being so anti-universal healthcare. it's the wrong thing to do, but I mean, just how anyone could argue against keeping the population healthy does seem just so utterly against all reasonable values. It's quite extraordinary, to put it very mildly.
We do have it. It's called Medicare, and that is for those who are 65 plus, and you are not touching the Medicare of any of those people. But the idea of extending that wonderful benefit down to the rest of our society is just an anathema to actually that group of people. It's quite contradictory.
Yeah.
And actually, I think the other piece that is probably not as obvious, but is our educational system is so incredibly unjust. And private education is incredibly expensive. Even state schools are costly, community college as well. But if you start at kindergarten or pre-K, there is such an inequity from the start that how do we expect these CEOs who are saying, I'm going to hire more people of color into my workplace and I'm going to support them. They have not been given the chance to build skills or be exposed to training enough to be able to fill those positions with confidence. And so we need the CEOs to stop writing these letters about changing their hiring practices and start giving their money back to the government in terms of tax reform so that it can be spread and used to grow the next generations so they don't have to face this. It's the educational aspect and problems in the United States are really not enough is talked about that. And we've done a lot of work on education as well. So just those basics of education for all, healthcare for all, food and housing security for all. Without those things, you have things like the opioid epidemic. I mean, seriously, there is a very strong link and mental health issues.
And yet you say, just talking about universal health care and education, and then in the culture wars, those on the other side will think you are utterly insane. Just bizarre. But meanwhile, you were talking earlier on about, before we started this, about some more really interesting work you've been doing under the title of Youth Educating Police. So perhaps just talk a bit about that, because it sounded absolutely amazing.
Yeah, we were contacted by a group to ask them. They wanted us to redesign their website, and Sparrow has a designer on staff, and it's a very small stipend that she was being paid to do this, and none of the rest of us was involved. But we realized how important this was, and we were so excited. So we're working on a pro bono basis for an organization that's just currently dominating our heads and our hearts right now. It's called YEP, and it's the, we're talking to them about the name, but it's Youth Educating Police. It was founded by two 15-year-olds, Britt and Taji, 3 years ago. So this was well before George Floyd. And it was, their concern was how the police deal with youth. Britt was in a criminal justice class, and he saw the statistic that said 3.1% of police encounters with young people are with young people aged 16 to 19, but 30.1% of the use of force incidents involve the same age group. So while they're not dealing with young people very often, when they deal with them, it is with force. And he couldn't let that fact go. So he partnered with his African-American friend Taji to say, let's do something about this. And when we started working on the website design, we realized we had to go back and do basic rebranding with them. We had to go back and understand their origin story. Why did you want to start this? It was, their website consisted of a lot of information that they pulled from grant applications, which is how they've been funded for the last 3 years. And it shows. So we needed to go back to the essentials of why they're doing this and how they're different and special. So we ended up just doing a virtual strategy session with them. And we wanted to find their origin story, get the right tone, voice, and their story. So we focused on brand, the basis of brand positioning, proof points, character and personality, and values. So the kids now, I mean, they prove to be natural marketers. And on our side, we're just encouraged every day by their optimism and their energy. The fact that they've been working on this for 3 years, they've just been bombarded by calls from the press and others to say, hey, with the issues of Black Lives Matter and social justice, what are you guys doing? What's your point of view on police reform? What is your philosophy? Do you want to abolish the police or do you want to train them? And so we've been working through that with them as well. What is your philosophy? And there's a group of five. There's two women in Chicago. They're all high school students at this point. One of them wanted to abolish the police. That's what she said her goal was. And Taji and Britt said, no, we can't abolish them if we're trying to train them. So we had to go back to how are you going to talk about this at a time when the national rhetoric is so vitriolic. And we've landed on, we are about conversations. We are about making sure that youth and police can have dialogue and learn from each other. And that's how they're moving forward. So stay tuned. We're still looking for a copywriter if anybody's interested in helping out. We've got the points that need to be, we've been able to say it straight. Now we need to be able to say it great. So if anybody wants to hop on and help, as I said earlier when we were talking, Sean, these kids at 15 were afraid of the police, and they're looking forward to a life where maybe in 20 years they're 35 years old and they are George Floyd with a police officer's knee on their necks. And can you even start to imagine living that life now as a 15-year-old and then looking forward to a future where it's going to be more of the same? That is what drives these kids. And they're not all Black. They're Hispanic, and Britt is a Caucasian kid who just really cares about his friends and doesn't think that it's fair that they have to live that life when he doesn't.
Wow, how fantastic, how inspiring. And also, say again, and then shifting over to straight sort of brand world again in terms of things that also are inspiring and good. I mean, over here that there have been, I mean, during the pandemic, you know, quite a few sort of examples of brands or organizations or corporates that have actually done something useful and worthwhile, going back to your points about how to build trust, etc. Any examples over there that spring to mind in terms of say brands or organizations that have been inverted commas, if you like, had a good pandemic in terms of actually having stood up to be counted and done something genuinely useful and meaningful?
What I have identified is that there's a lot of giving back. There's a lot of letters from CEOs. There was a lot of commercials, creative director sent me a clutter reel where everybody right after COVID was talking, using the same language. And it was overwhelming. It's like, don't do that. But what I have seen beyond the giving donations to certain causes is this desire for companies to try to figure out how to approach healthcare within their company or their point of view on Black Lives Matter. And I mean, Nike and Wyden did it with Kaepernick years ago.
Yeah, of course. Totally.
And it was quite a conversation between the agency and Nike. Is that going to be appropriate? But they were brave. And I think that the organizations that are rethinking, reimagining, and rebuilding are the ones that are going to get ahead. Just this morning, I mean, I think what we're seeing is just new paradigms. And this is for categories and industries. It's not a one-off that a business has done, but it's a fundamental shift in how they actually make their money or have their impact. So every day there's evidence of creative and innovative approaches to the old ways of doing business. So just this morning in the New York Times, I read that the movie studio Universal Pictures and the largest movie chain in the world, AMC Entertainment, announced a deal to bring movies to theaters and homes a mere 3 weeks apart versus the 90 days that the cinemas have demanded for years. The studios have wanted to move that way because Amazon and Netflix, basically Netflix won all the Academy Awards. The studios needed to compete, but they were held hostage by the cinemas. Given that the pandemic has kept all the theaters closed, it's going to change the way Hollywood does business forever. And that is interesting to me, the fact that log jams in terms of old traditional ways of doing things are changing because of the pandemic. And then another one is a local venue space here in Portland called the Alberta Rose. They can't have events. So they're selling t-shirts, they're selling pies from local pie makers, local beverages, beer and wine for home delivery or pickup. And all the profits are going just to cover their fixed costs to keep the to keep paying the rent on the theater. And so many people have shifted their purchases from the grocery chains to support this beloved place. So it's just a way that local has become really important. At the same time, Amazon is on every street delivering packages. Yeah. So one of our big concerns with we're a city that really does like to buy local, but at the same time, how are local businesses going to respond to the behemoth that's just gotten bigger? And then the last example that I really like is this. It's a farm in Half Moon Bay in California, and they are a sanctuary for animals, particularly goats. Well, nobody came to visit them, so they didn't have any donations, so they weren't able to feed their goats. They started something called Goat to Meeting, and they allow goats to appear in company meetings. And so it's just, once again, if you go, you can see their website. They did not have any of this infrastructure to have goats show up at meetings until the pandemic. They typically charge like $65 to $250 for like various virtual interactions with the animals. But they've started to line extend, and they do a VIP tour of the farm. And you can get that if you donate $750. So I think that it's just this, what I think, and this was one of the main points I wanted to get across, is in our industry, creativity was always like, well, that's for the creatives. And I've always argued that planners are just as creative as our account people and media people. But creativity, you're seeing it in parents, you're seeing it in neighborhoods, you're seeing it in local businesses and in governments. And so this idea of creativity, innovation, thinking a new way is it's really fascinating to see. And I do think that's where the hope comes from, is that creativity is not limited to creatives, but it's in human beings. And we are problem solvers. And we are taking actions that are going to make a difference for the long run. I think we've got systemic change that's going to require creativity. We need a vaccine. And I'm in awe of the scientists around the world collaborating and innovating and thinking with the best of their skills to come up with that. I do think that this has been a time of reflection and problem solving and creativity and innovation. not just limited to the innovation companies.
That's
going to be, you know, gaining confidence in trying new things is just going to be better as we move forward to transformation in a lot of, at least the American institutions.
Yeah. Whoa. Well, look, I mean, Jen, it's been absolutely fantastic, but I think our time is nearly up, but it's been absolutely amazing. So just before we begin to finish off, so what's on the short to medium term horizon for you then? What are you up to?
Well, I'm going to continue to ride my bike in the wilderness, which is what I was doing last week. And
that photograph extent was incredible. 15,000 foot, 5 days.
Yeah, 252 miles on a gravel bike. That was called social distancing in the Wallawas and in a place appropriately called Hell's Canyon. I've been working actually with the farm workers out in Hillsboro, which is east of or west of Portland, and they are mostly immigrants who are picking our fruits and vegetables. So I've been working with them to basically use my Spanish to help them do the basic life things that they need to do. They tend to be the victims of coronavirus more than others because they live together. So I've been helping the Northwest Farm Workers Union, and that's been pretty, it's once again, what I like to do. And I think what I'm good at is bridging cultures, and whether it's an organization that needs to understand the people they serve or a company trying to have a legitimate role in a consumer's life. That's my job. I'm like, I'm the intermediary that can listen to both and find common ground. And that's the kind of experience that I get when I go out and work with the farm workers. They are not the same as the people that I live with, but they are human beings that I really enjoy and learn from. So I think that's, and I go forward. And I think the other thing that I've been doing a lot of is we mentor a lot of kids, and we now have one who's working for a good gaming company in LA. Another went down to Chaya Day. We've got a fabulous person who's worked for us for a year, recent graduate from the Portland State Advertising Program, and he's ready to launch as well. But I think at this point in my career, what I love to do is teach and to share what I've learned with other people. That is where I spend my time rather than I'm not a very good social media person, nor am I tweeting, nor am I. I'm more of an analog person, and my interactions are pretty human to human. So I hope to teach and more regularly at Portland State or at the University of Oregon. I don't need to go east to some fancy school. I would like to help people here locally and teach them a little bit of the things that I've learned. Because I still believe, Sean, what you and I do as either account planners, researchers, strategists is so fundamentally important to getting the brand right that I will do whatever I can to ensure that some of the things I've learned are shared with others.
Whoa. Nicely put. Well, as you mentioned, as you don't stoop to the sordid world of sort of social media, so in that case, just the listeners are clear, actually, how can they track you down?
You can find me by telephone. It's the United States, 503-729-5009. I'm on LinkedIn, and our website, which is atrocious, that's one of the things we're going to work on during this pandemic time, is gosparrow.com. We also have an offshoot called sparrowdayone.com, and that is our collaboration product. We're making that virtual. That's the other thing that we're working on. My email is jen@gosparrow.com. That's how you can find me.
Fantastic. Well, look, that's been absolutely amazing. So Jen Ehrich, the marketing strategist, the renowned marketing strategist who specializes in solutions that work in the real world for real people with real results, creating strategies for action based on genuine human insights. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.